Welcome to Man Week on Radio Gorgeous. And returning to Radio Gorgeous, I'm very pleased to say, is Graham McRae Burnett, author of The Disappearance of Adele Badeau, His Bloody Project, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, and now The Accident on the A35. Welcome, Graham.
Thanks for having me, Donna. It's great to be back.
Excellent. Could you give us the scenario of the accident on the
A35. Well, Donna, in my first novel, The Disappearance of Adele Badeau, I pretended that this was a translation of a book written by a French author called Raymond Bruny, who I should emphasize doesn't exist. But in that book, I provided a biography of Raymond Bruny in which it's revealed that his father was killed in an accident on the A35. What a coincidence. So the new book, The Accident on the A35, is kind of Raymond Bruny's fictional exploration of his own father's death. So it tells the story of a fatal car accident in which a rather austere lawyer called Bertrand Bartholomé is killed. And the central characters are George Gorski, who we met in the first book, and the local detective, and Bertrand Bartholomé's 17-year-old son, Raymond. So the novel's really about the impact of this event on these two characters' lives.
And for this book, we return to, as you painted, the rather lackluster town of Saint Louis.
Nondescript is the word I used most often in the first book. It was quite funny when I was doing research for the accident. I went back to Saint Louis just to kind of hang around the cafes and get the ambience and all the details that I think bring the books to life. And the first two times I'd been in the town, it was the middle of winter. In that part of France, it's right on the border with Switzerland. It's really very cold in the winter. It's very grey. And Saint Louis didn't look great. But when I went back this time, it was June or July, and it was 35 degrees. There was blossom on the trees. There was a lovely canal that I'd never come across before. I was like, oh, it's actually quite nice, this place. So I thought, I need to be kinder about the town in the second book. But because I was writing in the persona of Raymond Bruny, who himself was born and brought up in Saint Louis and was trapped there and had all this resentment for his hometown, I couldn't really allow myself to be nicer about it. But it's not such an unpleasant place, but it's painted in a rather unkind light. But it is a small provincial town where, you know, nothing much is ever really going to happen.
The atmosphere of a small town, one, because we're returning to Saint Louis in this book, but also did play a role in His Bloody Project. Mm. And that sort of claustrophobic, yeah, feeling where people live so observably, mm, and yet because it's so observable, it's undiscussed.
Well, I mean, the word you use, claustrophobia, is, you know, the word I use, and it's, you know, I don't really plan things out, but it's amazing for me that, you know, in His Bloody Project, which is on the face of it a very different book set in 19th century Scottish village, and these two other books set in a small French town, but the characters they feel themselves very constricted by their environment, and the setting of all the books plays a really important role in the relationship of the characters and where they live. And there's this need to escape, and there's this kind of paranoia that everything you do or say is going to be observed and commented upon. So yeah, I mean, it's interesting to realise I've kind of repeated, without intending to, certain sort of tropes, or if I can use that word. And maybe it's also, I come from a small town in Scotland myself, you know, Kilmarnock, which is a town of 50,000 people. It's not so claustrophobic, but as a teenager, you know, I had this desire to leave the town, you know, as I think, you know, healthy teenagers should. You know, you want to see a little bit more of the world. You feel that things are happening elsewhere.
Yeah, because instead of the, you know, for sensitive people, or as you say, which I'd like to explore in a minute, adolescents, it's not this romantic, everyone, you know, community. It's actually intensely isolating.
Isolating, and I mean, I think especially in His Bloody Project, it is a very isolated community. It's a long way from anywhere. And Roddy McRae, who's also 17, just like Raymond Bartholomew, you know, he feels constricted and isolated.
I think also that aspect of life is so intensified at adolescence.
Yeah, absolutely.
That thing that you're absolutely see through it.
Yeah, I think the reason I was drawn to write about these characters at this particular age was because it is the age where you're moving. You're no longer a child. You're becoming an adult and moving, starting to think and want to do things in the adult world. So you're kind of forming yourself, and there's a lot of play made of Raymond sort of acting particular roles, and it's as if he's trying to find out who he is or who he's going to become, and he's leaving his childhood behind. I mean, in a way, I mean, I suppose, again, this is not particularly intended in the writing of the book, but, you know, the book opens with the death of his father, and, you know, unlike, you know, most people who would experience that, you know, as a very sad event, to be grief-stricken, Raymond experiences a kind of liberation. You know, he feels that the sort of his father has been very strict and, you know, quite unkind, or a very, very cold figure. So he feels liberated, the shackles are off, so he begins to do things that he wouldn't previously have felt able to do.
Yes. And there is, as you say, you brought up the word trapped.
Mm.
And I get this. I always get the sense with your characters, and I'm always on edge reading your book, and I'm inexorably pulled towards sort of this bus wreck.
Yeah.
But they are trapped, like they're trapped under glass. It's like we're watching them.
Yeah, they're trapped by their circumstances in their small towns, villages. But they're also kind of trapped by their sensibility, and by the, you know, once, and hopefully in all the books, once one action has been committed by the characters, then they find themselves, the rest of the book follows from that, and they're kind of trapped by their previous actions. In the very first book, Manfred Baumann lies about a certain event for no particular reason other than that he doesn't want to get involved. And if he hadn't lied, then things would have turned out differently. So, but that lie traps him in a chain of events which he's not in control of. And I think that sort of lack of control that the characters have over their own destiny, if you like, you know, is certainly, again, something you'll find in all the books. They don't have full agency or volition over their actions.
I also felt that in this book, something that I absolutely love when I come across in a literary context is a certain circularity.
Mm.
A subtle circularity in mirroring. And Gorski, our detective, is similarly trapped, and similarly his actions lead inexorably to other things. And we see his sort of strengths and flaws blossom.
Yeah, I think the difference for me between Gorski and Raymond is Gorski is a, you know, he's a fully grown man. He's, I don't know, 48, 49, 50, that kind of age. And he's kind of, I think, you know, when he was younger, he had these dreams that Raymond might have had in his, in the present tense of this novel. He dreamt of maybe becoming a cop in Marseille or Paris and investigating exciting, dramatic cases. But in a way, he's kind of, in one of the books, it says he's found his level, and he's come to an acceptance that actually he doesn't have the temperament to be a big city cop and to take on these sort of dramatic cases. And in a way, he's the most settled character. And whether, you know, that's out of a feeling of resignation or that's just how he is, you know, it's up to the reader to decide, I suppose. But it's also like, you know, he's not the sort of alpha male cop that you often find in detective fiction, who either goes around beating people up or, you know, in these kind of long interrogation scenes, or has these amazing flashes of intuition. I think of Gorski as a, first of all, as a man, whose job it is. You know, he is a detective. That's his job. He's not primarily a detective. Primarily, he's a character. And that's the kind of side of both the books that I'm interested in. You know, as I said at the beginning, that what is the impact of this event on Gorski? What does it lead him into?
Yes, and in the same way that Raymond's life is observed, as is Gorski's, especially, and he is in some ways like Manfred, like Raymond, as self-conscious about his observed behaviors and choices.
Yeah.
You know, his habits, the habits, you know, as measured against the habits of his predecessor, he's conscious of that and conscious of how he's perceived.
Yeah.
You know,
that's right,
all, you know, throughout the town, throughout his precinct, throughout...
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things that makes me think of at the very beginning of the book when we meet Raymond, who's in his bedroom, and the house, the geography of the house is described, and Raymond's father, who's been killed, he always leaves the door of his study open, and this makes... Raymond feels that this is so he can keep tabs on the movements of people in the house. It's a kind of panopticon effect, you know, everything is visible. And with Gorski, we're often reminded of things that his predecessor Ribery has said, which he doesn't agree with. Ribery was just a sort of small town cop who liked to have a long lunch and, you know, spend the afternoon going around the local bars. Nothing wrong with that. What was the other? There's another aspect to that. I've forgotten.
You know, his sort of life seems to play out like Manfred's before him. His life plays out in the restaurant in the Clutch.
Well, that's right. Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking of. He's so desperate to sort of assert his own individuality and not be just fit into the shoes of his predecessor that he continually switches tables in the restaurant rather than adopt a particular table, and as he would be accorded by as being the chief of police. But, you know, and it's such a sort of arbitrary way of trying to assert his freedom that he knows it's ridiculous.
Yes, and he knows that it's just as much a pattern. You know, trying to break the pattern is just as much of a pattern as having, keeping the same table.
Yeah, and Gorski's wife, Celine, has also left him, and early on in the novel, you know, he's adjusting to the freedom that brings him. And because this kind of freedom that he seeks is at a very low level, and there's a line where it says, you know, one day, as if to assert the limits of his freedom, he decided not to shave. You know, this is his rebellious act, you know, because he's not, you know, as I say, he's quite an ordinary person. He's not going to, you know, rush off and have a wild erotic affair. Well, maybe. We'll see. But, you know, he's a very sort of decent kind of guy, you know.
And what also occurred to me is that, like the disappearance of Adele Badeau, the accident on the A35, for the people who are involved, it's seismic.
Absolutely.
You know, for Raymond, it's seismic. But for us observing it, it's quotidien. It's,
I love that word.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, workaday and humdrum.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
but for living inside this...
Yeah, yeah. I think that's... I mean, the character in the first book, Manfred Baumann, he, at a certain point, he lives a very routinized life and has lunch in the restaurant de la Cloche every day. And one day he changes his order. And he imagines this huge furore in the kitchen, and Manfred Baumann has changed his order, and he thinks there are going to be all sorts of repercussions to this action, and he looks around him as if to see, you know, the looks on people's faces. But of course nobody's paying any attention because it's a completely humdrum thing, but there's a huge exaggeration in his mind of the drama, or his own significance as well, because he thinks that people are scrutinizing his behavior. The sad thing is they're not. He's a nobody. And I think, you know, certainly with Raymond has some of these characteristics as well of overthinking. I enjoy writing these kind of, you know, the action that takes place inside the minds of the characters, contrasted with, as you say, the sort of everyday humdrum reality of those actions. But, you know, it's very dramatic. you know, Raymond, when he has some adventures in the neighbouring town of Mulhouse or Mulhouse, and you know, the drama of asking directions, you know, which is something that I personally find a quite traumatic experience as well. But, you know,
exposing ignorance.
Yeah, and you know, I found with the first book that, you know, certain readers completely relate to this kind of paranoid overthinking, and other people just think it's a sort of what's wrong with that character. I mean, until the book came out, I thought I was completely normal. But I discovered that apparently I'm not, and actually I toned these things down to try to make them plausible, such as my own sort of trauma with, you know, the everyday transactions of life.
Well, and I also felt that, and perhaps it's just okay, I'm thinking two things. One, you've created such a true picture, a fictionally believable picture for me, and such a full story that I think what I've seen of Manfred's life in the disappearance of Adele Bedeau, then certainly what happened to him, what he experienced as a teenager, was formative and created.
Absolutely.
and sort of kept him in that
adolescent
state until his death, and that I can say with absolute fictional certainty that that Raymond will be similarly formed.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, I think there is the sense in The Disappearance of Adele Bedeau that Raymond's, that Manfred's personality has been formed by certain events in his teenage years, and you know, in general, with all the characters, I think there's a sense that the character's existence in the present tense of the novels, or if you think about what future they might have, has been formed in their past. Gorski's father was a pawnbroker, you know, and he's kind of risen above his own station, or his family's station, by becoming the chief of police. He's never sure if he was kind of promoted by what is, you know, his sort of high bourgeois wife's father as the mayor. And so he feels insecure in these sort of higher social circles. And again, he's more comfortable with, you know, the people in a bar rather than the people in a fancy restaurant. He's more comfortable, you know, going to see an old lady who's misplaced some tools in her garden and has called the police, than going to Strasbourg to help to investigate a murder. But the past. And this is, you know, in my favourite author, Georges Simenon, you always find that the past of the characters is very present in their thinking. They're always reminded of little things from their childhood just by a colour or a smell, in that kind of Proustian way. And, you know, with Raymond Barthelme in this book, because he's 17, we don't know how it's going to play out in the future.
I like the mirroring with Gorski. You know, an experience when he was similar age, and you're talking about his insecurities, and there's a mezuzah on the wall, and that sort of, and again, unspoken comments and questions that he doesn't have the courage to ask.
Well,
and
I mean,
linger in the mind.
I suppose maybe that's my sort of Scottish upbringing, where, you know, in the west of Scotland, probably in Scotland in general, you know, you're not brought up in this environment where let's talk through our problems. You know, it's basically, you know, don't, you know, you're not encouraged to ask questions and discuss stuff. And I think, you know, Gorski's upbringing is like that. And the little, it's kind of a little bit of backstory. It's almost like a little short story within the novel, where he remembers an incident where some Mormons have come to the house and pointed out a mezuzah on the doorpost. And, you know, Gorski doesn't know whether it's just a bit of ornamentation that may have been in the house before his parents arrived, or it was brought up from the pawn shop below as a kind of knick-knack. He doesn't know his own identity, you know, and that's that sort of uncertainty about who he is and insecurity when he's in the world. And that, I think that, yeah, all these things lead to him being a sort of rather unself-confident character.
Excellent. Before we reveal too much, because obviously these are still detective stories in a sense.
Yeah, yeah, especially this one, I think.
Yeah, and yeah. can certainly be read. And there was certainly, as in a traditional detective story, there's certainly the page-turning desire to know, you know, what occurred.
Yeah, I mean, it's always good when people say they found it, the book to be a page-turner. But I think that kind of compulsion to read on, of course it can come from a sort of mystery element. I mean, both Raymond and Gorski are engaged in a sort of investigation to find out where Bertrand Bartle may have been on the night of his death, because he wasn't where he said he was. So there is, in a way, a quite traditional quest. But I think the compelling, or for me, and what's compelling in the novel is, you know, Raymond meets a girl and arranges a date. Will she turn up, you know, when he's sitting in the cafe, or is she going to stand him up? You know, later on, Gorski's trying to sort of fix things up with his wife, Celine. And, you know, these scenes hold every bit as much, if not more, drama and tension and, you know, sometimes sort of excruciating embarrassment, you know, than the sort of investigations that are more the sort of conventional part of a detective novel. But I mean, I think those parts of detective fiction are also there. But I do get a bit more excited about, you know, will somebody turn up for a date, you know, or will the stomach churning? Yeah, exactly. You know, I think there's almost everybody can relate to that sort of thing, you know, or making a sort of social faux pas. I'm just feeling totally crushed by it. I mean, I have much experience of that. Yeah.
Well, okay, so let's get to that, because you were able to write The Disappearance of Adele Bajot without anyone bothering you,
mm-hmm.
and then His Bloody Project,
mm-hmm.
and I assume you had started The Accident on A35 while all the hoopla of being first long-listed, then short-listed, yeah, for the Man Booker Prize started.
Well, very luckily, I just finished, just before the long-listing for the Booker Prize, I just finished the first draft of The Accident. So I had it in the bank. To me, the first draft is a kind of skeleton where you get to the end of the story. So it's, the characters are there, you know who they are, the main events of the story, and there might be a few missing bits. I write very chronologically, but I had that there in the bank, and I'm so glad I did, because with the attention that the Booker Prize bought, of course, everything, you know, it's like I've become one of my characters. Everything is scrutinized, and whereas my previous books, you know, sneaked gently out, or snuck, as you might say, gently out into the world without anybody paying attention, it was clear that because of, you know, what happened with His Bloody Project, that The Accident would get quite a lot of attention, and as it has been. And, you know, His Bloody Project is quite a grand scale novel in a way, although the setting is very small. It's got big themes, and it's got a very sort of obvious kind of literary structure and literary devices. Adele Bajot and The Accident, they're sort of quieter novels. They're small scale, and there's kind of little dramas we've been talking about ordering in a restaurant. They're kind of about the minutiae of life. So, you know, there's a certain anxiety about how the book would be received, you know, after having a successful sort of larger scale novel. But, you know, thankfully, so far, it's been pretty much all good.
And in The Accident on the A35, amongst the many clever things that you've managed to do, one of the clever things that you managed to do is to the author, mm-hmm. who, as we know, does not exist, but left Hackley two manuscripts.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, at the very beginning of the book, it's described that Adele Bajot was thought to be his only novel, which he wrote before he committed suicide, in time-honoured fashion, of course. And at the beginning of the book, we learn that on the occasion of Raymond Bruni's mother's death, almost 30 years later, two manuscripts were sent by courier to his publisher in Paris, the instruction being that they could only be sent after his mother died. So there's a kind of feeling that there must be something in these novels that he didn't want his mother to learn. And that kind of ties in with this sort of investigation into what his father was up to on the night that he was murdered. So, yeah, hopefully it ties in. But, yes, as you mentioned, there was two manuscripts. So we'll just have to wait and see what the third one contains. But there will be no further manuscripts discovered of that, I'm quite sure.
Even if there are, I'm sure there would be a very clever way in which
I think you've got to... I'm quite happy with the device in this book. I think it's quite neat, and I enjoy that kind of playfulness, I think it should be taken as playfulness. There's a serious element to it, but it can just be there to be enjoyed almost like a sort of DVD extra to a film. Or you can really sort of try to think about how the fictional author Raymond Bruni's life relates to the content of the novels, and that's quite fun too, I think. It's also, as a writer, the reason I wrote The Accident was not because I was trying to exploit something commercially. It's because I wanted to return to the world of San Luis. I love that world. In fact, I started writing the book before Adele Badeau was even published, which is a very foolhardy thing to do. I wrote a draft of maybe 20,000 words at that time. I mean, I never even went back and looked to it when I started writing again. But it's just the world of those books is one that really appeals to me. And I felt like Gorski was a character who he kind of becomes prominent, you know, maybe about a third of the way through Adele Badeau. So he's not really the central character. Although he becomes has equal weight almost with Manfred, but he moves centre stage in this book, and I suppose I wanted to spend more time with him. So I hope other people enjoy San Luis as well, a return trip.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Graham.
Thank you, Donna.